Welcome to the Country Hour. I'm Warwick Long. Today, we're going out on farm, where some city slicker teenagers are learning how to milk. But it's another liquid that's looming large over the headlines, where we'll begin the program today with South Australia being accused of ignoring advice to use environmental water to get the best outcome for the environment in the Murray-Darling. A leaked letter shows the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder wrote to South Australia in 2015, urging the state not to withhold the environmental water it owned, rather than use it with Commonwealth's water to get the best outcome. The letter warned that not using the water posed additional risks to the Coorong and undermined the environmental watering schedule. The South Australian government, though, ignored that request. We'll hear from the Minister for Water in South Australia shortly. I'd also like your view. 1300 977 222 is our number. Is this just more politics in water? 1300 977 222 is the number to call us. You can text on 0467 842 722. South Australia hasn't legally done anything wrong here. Its environmental water is its to do with what it pleases. But have they done the right thing? You can text us 0467 842 722. We'd love to get your views here on the Country Hour. And as you can imagine, the South Australian Water Minister has come out swinging against these allegations. South Australians are now accusing New South Wales interests of using this leaked letter to cover up their own mismanagement of water as the mudflinging over the Basin Plan continues. Minister Ian Hunter says his state and his department have done nothing wrong.
This is just a desperate beat up by those people trying to cover up water theft in New South Wales, trying to distract people from actually looking at what's been criminal activity in New South Wales and actually taking water that was meant for the environment. That's not the situation in South Australia. They're trying to confuse people with the situation. But what happens here is we have a full entitlement of about 1,850 gigalitres per year. And of that, about 876 gigalitres are used for water use, so irrigators, SA water and the environment. And then there's a remaining amount, up to 278 gigs, which is able to be deferred for very important reasons, either for producers who haven't utilised it in a water year, or and that's called carryover, or for SA Water to hold on to for critical human water needs in drier years.
So what was done in this case? What was that 45 gigalitres used for?
It was held back for drinking water. 90% of South Australians depend on Murray water for drinking purposes. And the Murray-Darling Basin Agreement makes it absolutely plain that the highest purpose is for critical human water needs. And that's what South Australia was fighting for all this time. Because if the Murray dries up for us, it not only impacts our economy, but it also impacts our ability to actually put water into the pipes into homes.
Did your department ignore the Commonwealth Environment Water Holder's advice when it advised you not to defer
water? No, it wasn't advice. And the fact was they didn't put any environmental water down the system in December anyway. What they were saying is they were looking at it, and our desire to actually hold water back for a dry water year for people in our state to drink meant that they couldn't get quite the same levels. But in fact, they didn't put any water down in December at all, and back in 2015, I think it was. And that's all it was about. It was about we wanted to release environmental water. If you release some at the same time, we can get a higher peak. And we were saying, well, you're advising us, the MDBA, that next year is going to be a very dry year. We think it's more prudent to actually save that water for drinking water purposes. And I must say, no one in the Commonwealth has indicated any concerns about our decisions-making in that area. I think you'll find that they'll suggest that it was prudent as well.
You say it's not advice, but this is the letter from David Papps, the Commonwealth Environment Water Holder, to your department. The letter says, and this is a quote, "My office has asked your department to reconsider plans to defer entitlement flow over the summer months to help increase barrage flows into the Coorong over summer while maintaining minimum lake levels. However, these plans remain unchanged. I am concerned that South Australia's plan to defer entitlement flow during summer poses additional risks to the Coorong and undermines the effective use of Commonwealth environmental water to achieve agreed objectives under the water schedule and the basin plan." This sounds like advice to me.
No, it wasn't advice at all. And yet they didn't release any water in December of that year. And there were no detrimental effects to the Coorong.
But that's because they subsequently sent 150 gigalitres because they wanted to make sure the lower lakes were
safe. The primary purpose of the MDBA plan is to provide for critical human use and our needs. And Every state has to provide for that. It is our responsibility as a state government and Victoria and New South Wales as well to provide for critical human water needs in coming years, and that's what we do.
And but these are environmental flows, and this is what you were critical of New South Wales about when there were the alleged water theft allegations there.
You're wrong, Marty. You're absolutely wrong, and you're just listening to this misinformation that's being put about by New South Wales, who are desperate to cover up criminal water theft. That's what they're trying to do. This is not environmental water at all, and never has been.
So New South Wales is taking a shot at SA over this story, but are you now taking one back at them for this story, for saying they shouldn't be bringing it up?
Look, there's something crooked happening in New South Wales. We all know about it. We heard it on the ABC. This is why we need to have a Commonwealth-led Royal Commission to get the bottom of it. If they've got allegations to raise about SA's application of the rules, let them bring them to a Royal Commission. What have they got to hide? We've got nothing to hide.
That's the South Australian Water Minister Ian Hunter speaking there to Marty McCarthy, defending the decision to withhold 45 gigalitres of water for the environment with the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder and keeping that water for water for Adelaide, for water for South Australia there. What do you think about that? You can tell us. You can call 1300 977 222 or you can text 0467 842 722. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 11 past 12, and while the fighting over the Basin Plan continues in South Australia and New South Wales are at loggerheads, what do Victorian interests make of this fight and this latest revelation? Richard Anderson is the chair of the Victorian Farmers Federation Water Committee, and he can join us now on The Country Hour. Welcome to the program, Richard Anderson.
Thanks, Warren.
South Australia withheld its water, which by rights it can do, but did the state do the right thing by the Murray-Darling in your view?
Oh, look, we expect here in Victoria, and I can only speak from a Victorian perspective, but we expect our Victorian Environmental Water Holder to work closely with the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder to get the best possible outcomes and use of environmental water. And look, it's unclear from what's been said on this subject whether it was actually even the environmental water that they were withholding. We're all aware of the critical human needs and provisions within the plan, and I guess that was a judgment call, but it is unclear as to whether it was actually environmental water that was being withheld.
And how is it frustrating for you when allegations are made about New South Wales, and then there's reviews and so forth going on there, but nothing has I suppose changed after those allegations at all. And South Australia, quite rightly against those allegations, would raise concerns there. But then when it goes the other way, when concerns are raised about South Australia, they dismiss it all as a cover up.
Sounds like a bit of tit-for-tat to me. But
does it get anywhere with a basin plan? Does it help anything?
Well, I don't think it's constructive, not by a long shot. Look, New South Wales have some compliance issues. We've been made aware of those. Hopefully they'll be investigated. Metering here in Victoria, we've always been big on the metering and certainly on compliance with entitlements. But I wouldn't go too far into a mud-slinging match. It wasn't that many years ago that they were actually installing meters down at the lower end of the Murray system in South Australia. That wasn't that many years ago they were putting the meters in for the first time. So I think it's easy in hindsight to throw mud around, but those things should be investigated properly. I'm not saying that we don't have compliance issues, but we certainly have everything needed here in Victoria. And if you do the wrong thing, you generally end up being investigated and go through the court system.
And I might pick up on that with you in a moment, but I suppose just going back to what Ian Hunter, the Water Minister in South Australia, said, saying that the decision by the South Australian government was to keep that water, that environmental reserve, because they needed it for critical human needs. He would have a point there, wouldn't he? Water for Adelaide would be more important than water for the environment, wouldn't it?
Look, I think we all recognise that's why the critical human needs provisions have been put in. I mean, we all recognise that, households and towns, not just in South Australia, right along the river, are going to be the first priority. And I guess the judgment call, as Ian Hunter said, the judgment call was that they might need that water for town supply.
Even when the state has a desal plant for Adelaide as well?
Yeah, well, that's always going to be a controversial issue too. Is the desal plant big enough to cover their needs? But it's not just about water for Adelaide. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, most towns are built along the river, whether they be in Victoria, New South Wales, South Australia, or wherever. So it's water for not just for the capital. It's water for all the towns, and I guess that was a judgment call. I can understand from the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holders' point of view, you know, we're going to put some down. As it turns out, they didn't anyway in that month, but we're going to put some down. You get the best outcome by using yours at the same time. But look, that's up to the states. They put up their environmental watering plans, and from a Victorian perspective, we expect our Victorian environmental water holder to work closely with the Commonwealth environmental water holder so that we get the best value.
You mentioned the metering in the Murray-Darling Basin. It's almost the source of a lot of these mudslinging and concerns around the basin plan, whether it be in the northern part of the basin or South Australia as well. Why hasn't throughout the plan some standardised metering or monitoring been put in place throughout the entire river system to know how much water is moving where and when?
Oh, look, I think ultimately that would be the end goal, to have everything metered, but it costs money and it's a slow process, as we've seen, just ensuring that everyone is complying under the basin plan. You know, the states have a cap. Each state has in their entitlement framework within that cap, and it's up to the state to make sure that compliance is being adhered to. And of course, it's up to the MDBA to make sure that the cap reports that are going in have got some accuracy and legitimacy behind them.
We certainly know through a lot of the discussion in the last few months that New South Wales meetings metering particularly north of their state aren't up to scratch. But what about South Australia? What's their standard like?
Oh, look, everything, to my knowledge, and you'd have to ask South Australia this, I think everything is now metered, but it wasn't that many years ago when they were still putting meters in as well. And you know, it's really up to the state to get that organised to make sure they're complying with their cap and pretty much to make sure that there's equity among entitlement holders in terms of who's getting what.
And so what do you make of this whole issue then? Is it a storm in a teacup?
Oh, I think it is to some degree. But as I said earlier, you know, here in Victoria, we expect our environmental water holder to work closely with the Commonwealth to make sure you get the best outcomes. You know, the Victorian environmental water holder holds water entitlements along with the Commonwealth, and they put up a watering plan, and it's usually a co-contribution. If you look in their reports, it's generally a co-contribution by both state and Commonwealth environmental water going into these sites.
And you've said that a few times now. Is that what you're worried about that isn't clear here, whether that was actually done across the border, whether the state and the Commonwealth are working in close enough sync with each other to make sure they're getting the maximum outcome?
Well, you know, that's up to the state, but, you know, it's not clear either as to whether this was just some reserve that they were holding back. Is this actually designated environmental water that they were holding back, or have they actually been holding back some of what their normal seasonal determination would have been to their own irrigators? That's unclear from what's been said so far.
Richard Anderson, thanks very much for your time on the program today.
Thank you.
That's Richard Anderson, who is the chair of the VFF's Water Council, speaking there. A few of your texts coming in on 0467 842 722. You can add your thoughts to the list if you'd like. 0467 842 722. The slogan of Nigel every time we talk about this has been texted in yet again. Can the plan MDB P, man-made disaster by politicians, says Nigel. Ash says, can you imagine the uproar if SA had not kept a reserve and the people had gone thirsty? Balancing the environment and human need is not easy. I'm no greenie, but I stand with SA on this issue, says Ash. Oh, and we've just had a... the text machine's decided to go a bit crazy. Oh, we're back now. Old Codger is making another joke again. With all the water being used to make mud for slinging, will there be any left? Says Old Codger. Thanks for that, Old Codger. That's a good one. And Bill at Redcliffe has says, more tit-for-tat squabbling going on between New South Wales and South Australia about waterside issues. Meanwhile, the bigger picture goes unexamined, and that is A, the joint effort by New South Wales and Victoria to cut back the water recovery needed for a viable Murray-Darling Basin plan, and B, South Australia's egregious failure to protect its own interest in obtaining a viable plan with adequate water recovery. That's from Bill in Redcliffs as well. Keep your thoughts coming, 0467 842 722. You're listening to The Country Hour.
Streaming right around the world, you're with The Country Hour, Australia's longest-running radio show.
And we'll move away from water for just a moment to a very different kind of liquid and very different kind of people as well. City high school students have swapped bustling streets for peaceful paddocks as part of a program that hopes to bridge the divide between city and country. The high school students from Melbourne's north recently spent a week on dairy farms across Gippsland for Rabobank's Farm Experience program. Isabella Pittaway caught up with 16-year-old Natasha and 15-year-old Dorothy, who'd had quite an unforgettable first milking experience.
We milked the cows and I got pooped on, which was not fun.
Oh no, had you ever milked a cow before?
No, first time.
And what was that experience like?
The pooped on was not good, but it was fun. I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't even know that cow was pooping on me.
Yeah.
Because I was doing it and then it just pooped on me.
Did you at least get some milk for your efforts?
No. Oh yeah, I did.
It was really fun and interesting to see like the whole process.
And what was that process like? Talk us through the experience.
So basically, they just send in the cows and then they get on this like machine and then we hook up and then it just like milks the cows. Yeah.
Apart from milking cows and getting pooped on, what are some of the other things you've learned?
I've learned about irrigation and how it works. I've learned that 90% of milk is water, and I didn't know that.
Can you tell us about irrigation and what you've learned there?
I've learned that the grass needs to like have water so that it grows and then the cows can eat it. But sometimes it gets too dry, so then they have to like spread water around.
What are the main differences, I guess, that you've found from, obviously, you're both from the city. Mm-hmm. What's been some of the differences you found out here in the country?
Well, like I said, it's peaceful and there isn't, like, much noise. I don't know how to explain it. Like, it's... You don't worry too much about, like, dirt and stuff, you know? Like, back in the city, everybody's, like, all clean and whatever. But here, it's just the way it is. Yeah.
The roads are not busy as like in the city. Mm-hmm. Which really busy.
Yeah.
It's really great here, like good weather, not really much rain.
Would either of you consider maybe a career in agriculture? Has this made you think of that as something to look into further down the track?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think so, because my dad wants to have a farm, so that could happen soon.
What kind of farm?
I don't know yet. I'm not sure what he thinks.
I think I would like a horse farm because I just love horses. Because I watch a lot of movies that's like on horses, so I just thought, why not?
So what did Tanamba Dairy Farm Manager Paul Timmins make of the City Slickers' efforts?
For two girls who've never been on a farm and milked cows before, they were fine. You've got to have the coordination of your hands and things like that. So you've got to do a couple of things at once. And they picked it up fine, really good.
And what sort of questions and have they been asking you about what goes on with dairy farming?
They've asked questions like watering, irrigation, how we feed the cows, how do we know if they've had enough what time we start milking and bits and pieces like that. Penicillin cows, what we treat them with.
Did you get them up nice and early for the milking on Tuesday or?
The first 2 days, 8 o'clock start and that, but tomorrow we've got pregnancy testing, so they'll be up early for that. And they'll get involved in that to see what happens with that.
And what do you see as the benefits of having city students come out to farms?
It gives them the opportunity to see what it's like and maybe possibly a career change for them if they're looking at it. So they get hands-on experience so they know what it's all about.
After a week on a dairy farm, 15-year-old Dorothy has some advice for her city peers.
I'll say be prepared for anything. Because you don't know what's going to happen, but you always got to be prepared.
That's Year 10 student Dorothy Ho-Fletch ending that story from Isabella Pettaway. How great's that story of milking poop? That's the first time I've ever heard it in that context. That's brilliant. Some more of your texts coming into the Country Hour here on 0467 842 722. We're talking about South Australia withholding some of their environmental water when requested by the Commonwealth Government. The government wanted it. South Australia withheld it, they say, for critical human needs, and it's their water. So they were allowed to decide what to do with it. And we're talking about whether that was right or not. James has tweeted from across the border in South Australia, and he said Richard Anderson from Victoria is talking more sense than most on the Victorian Country Hour. Thank you very much for James for that. I think it's a shot, but we'll accept it anyway. Also on text, Ash texted me back. I misquoted you, Ash, right as the text message machine went blank on me. I said, Ash says, I'm not a greenie, but he says, actually, I am. I am a greenie. I vote green, says Ash on the text. He was talking earlier about, could you imagine the uproar if SA had not kept a reserve for people and used the water for the environment instead? And another anonymous texter says, you quote gigalitres, but never over what time period. Is it per hour, per year, or per decade? That was their allocation over that year that I was speaking about. Sorry for not being clear on that. And thanks for texting for a clarification as well on 0467 842 722. Let's talk another important topic now on the Country Hour, and that's mental health. Watching your crops die and the difficulties of farming can be hard on mental health and life on the land. For World Mental Health Day, one farmer says there needs to be a little less judging from over the fence and a little more talking to one another. Lily Hoffman spoke to Nick Shady from Lismore in southwest Victoria, who found himself strained after being left unable to sow this season.
Where I farm at the moment, it's been a really tough 2 years. We look over the fence and we say, you know, that bloke hasn't got his crop in, what's wrong with him? Like, well, he's been bogged that many times, he's actually sick of it, and thought, well, what's the point of being so frustrated about it? And I think that we, as a rural community, need to look after each other and consider what's going on, just not just by looking over the fence.
Nick was unable to sow this season after his property saw 7 to 8 inches of rain in January 2016, followed by floods later that year that completely waterlogged his canola. This was then backed up with rain in January of this year, and he says the rain has not stopped until 2 weeks ago. Watching his canola die around July of last year and then being left unable to sow was disheartening.
I think the frustration of going to the expense of putting the crops in and then seeing them die, and I did let a little bit of canola go through and I've ended up with a very weedy paddock. So quite stressful, because you only have to drive 5 or 10 kilometres the other side, and when a brother farms up near Skipton, the crops were exceptionally good because they didn't get that summer band of rain that I've managed to cop. And you have farmers that have dry areas and wet areas, and we're the same in the wet areas. If you've got no crop, it's quite stressful. You've got to front up again and put a crop in.
A lot of farmers' livelihood is obviously dictated by the weather. What kind of impact do you think that has on farmer health?
And I think it's that frustration where farmers use social media to express the way they feel, and it's interesting if you get together at a grower update and you stand around, and we have different conversations about how the year's going. We get there and we talk about people's health and just their well-being. And I think that that's something that we don't do well as a farming generation.
And what do you think maybe everyday farmers listening in who have had a tough run with their crop potentially, and what do you think farmers can do for each other and for themselves?
Well, we need to talk, and it's something that farmers especially, they don't want to talk about their health or if they're injured or they don't want to go to the doctor and get a checkup. They need to talk more about what's going on. And people say, oh, I don't want to talk to anyone, I don't want to put any burden on them. But I think as soon as you start verbalising what's going on, like you say, look, I'm trying the hardest I can and I'm working against Mother Nature and it's just not working out.
Dr. Alison Kennedy is a research fellow at the National Centre for Farmer Health and says factors like long hours, a lack of sleep and the pressure of working conditions all contribute to poor farmer mental health.
Often we can become sort of overwhelmed by those things that we're unable to control. You know, they're often the most stressful things, but the things that we can do least about. I'm very much an advocate for concentrating on those things that people can have an impact on and can control. I always think, you know, having a list of things that you're able to tick off as you achieve them can be really great for your well-being and your mental health.
That's Dr. Alison Kennedy from the National Centre for Farmer Health, ending that report by Lily Hoffman. And if you or someone you know requires support, we mention this number a lot, you should save it in your phone. Lifeline 13 11 14 is the number. Save it in your phone. Keep it for whenever you need it. 13, 11, 14. On the Country Hour now, let's get regional news headlines, find out what's happening around the state. Sue Peacock can tell us more. Hi, Sue.
Good afternoon, Warwick. The Western Highway west of Stawell will remain closed for most of the day after around 45,000 litres of diesel was spilled during a truck crash this morning. A petrol tanker was travelling through Deep Lead when it veered off the road, rolled and came to rest in a ditch shortly before 8 o'clock. Diversions are in place for the highway between Sandbar Road and the Warwick-Nabeel Stawell Road while authorities work to contain the diesel. A light plane has crash-landed at the Mildura Airport. The airport's chief executive, Bill Burke, says there was a problem with the plane's front tyre when landing this morning, sending its nose into the tarmac. He says no one was injured. Another councillor has quit Mount Alexander Shire in central Victoria, becoming the second departure within a week. Tony Bell resigned from the Castlemaine-based council yesterday after it lost its mayor on Friday. No reason has been given for Mr Bell's departure. The Victorian Government says it will spend more than $9 million to support struggling families in the Latrobe Valley. The funding comes from a transition fund set up to help the community deal with the closure of the Hazelwood Power Station. It will provide grants to help families to take part in community activities, including sport, and to build on work with the Aboriginal community to operate a gathering place in Morwell. And the fire danger period for the southern border area, taking in Albury and the Greater Hume, Federation and Berrigan Shires, will start a fortnight earlier than normal because of unseasonably dry weather. It means from next Monday, October the 16th, anyone wanting to light a fire will need a permit. Rural Fire Service Inspector Craig Warwick says the countryside is drying out quickly and its crucial landholders are preparing their properties for the fire season now. ABC News.
Thanks, Sue.
You're with the Country Hour, on air, online, and on the move. Join in today's broadcast at abc.net.au/rural.
We get to more of your texts shortly, but if you'd like to see more of our stories or more of rural life or some great stuff that you, our listeners, have been sending to us, head to our Facebook page. It's great. Some beautiful photos this week of sunrises over dairy cows. Also, a few footy and netball teams celebrating in canola paddocks after we had all that discussion about tourists in canola paddocks last week. If you'd like to see it all, Victorian Country Hour on Facebook. We'd love you to like our page and become part of our little community here on the Country Hour. Right now, though, let's find out what's happening weather-wise now. The weather report wasn't great yesterday and we got a lot of stick for it, so we'll go long today. We're ready to get every detail Tom Delamotte is prepared to give us today. How are you, Tom?
I'm well, Warwick. Yourself?
Are you ready for a full forecast?
Always ready. Always ready to go.
Let's start with today. It looks bright and sunny, especially in the north from today, but if you'd like to go through today and then get onto that and when rain's coming and where it's going to fall and when, we'd love to hear it all.
Absolutely. Yeah, so we do have the high pressure system centred over Victoria at the moment. Did result in clear skies overnight, and it got fairly cold to start off with, particularly through the southwest of the state. There were some temperatures getting down to zero or just below this morning, but it has warmed up fairly steadily with the clear skies. Just a little bit of cloud over the southwest of the state, but yeah, elsewhere, clear, light winds. We'll see some afternoon sea breezes today. But then as we move in tomorrow, that's all going to change. So we can see some, there's a cold front just moving up into southwest WA at the moment, and there's a lot of moisture in the interior of the continent as well. And that's going to get dragged down by this cold front as it approaches Victoria tomorrow. So we should see the cloud increase overnight and probably start off tomorrow with a bit of patchy light rain over the western districts. And that rain should pick up during the morning and early afternoon to some periods of moderate rain, and then start to move across the state during the afternoon and evening. We are expecting a period of fairly moderate to heavy rainfall just on the front as it moves through. So there could be sort of a 2-hour period there where we see rainfall totals in the order of sort of around 10 to 15 millimetres or so in that 2-hour period. So there could be some heavy rain as near that front as it moves through. So we are expecting that front to get into the western districts in the late afternoon tomorrow, move through the central districts in the evening, and then push through the eastern districts towards midnight and in the early hours of Thursday morning. So at this stage, it looks like rainfall totals should generally be in the order of 5 to 15 millimetres through the northwest of the state and also the far southeast, with generally falls around 10 to 25 millimetres elsewhere, and in the order of 25 to 35 millimetres about the ranges, set stretches through the central ranges and right out to the eastern ranges into Thursday morning.
So that's so Wednesday into Thursday, we start getting that rain across the state.
Yeah, mostly on Wednesday. It will sort of have cleared by through the western parts of the state during the evening on Wednesday, and it's just sort of that lingering part of the rain band through the central districts in the early hours of Thursday morning before it pushes out into the Tasman Sea. So it does look like it's going to be widespread rainfall there won't be many places, or I doubt there'd be any places unless they have a block gauge, which will end up with zero in the gauge. Should be at least that 5 to 15 looks like the minimum, which is up through the northwest and down through the far southeast Gippsland there.
So upwards of that, really, for
upwards of that,
yep.
Yeah, with the heaviest falls up to 35 millimetres around the ranges, so sort of stretching through the Grampians down through the Macedon Ranges and then out into the eastern ranges there, look like the areas where we'll see the heaviest falls. And yeah, so we'll sort of start off as light to moderate rain, and then there's going to be that period near the front sort of later on in the day where we do see heavier rain, and in much of the totals that we're going to end up with are going to sort of fall during that 2-hour period near the front. So yeah, if you sort of get to mid-afternoon tomorrow and you haven't seen a whole lot, most of it is going to be on the way, sort of that late afternoon, evening period and overnight for the eastern districts tomorrow.
And then it starts to clear Thursday? What's that look like?
Yeah, so it does, but before I get to that, it is going to be pretty windy as well ahead of this front. So we likely going to issue a severe weather warning for damaging winds for the elevated parts of Victoria. So through that central ranges, the Grampians and into the Alpine region as well. That'll probably start to see some damaging wind gusts from sort of late morning tomorrow. It looks like this stage continuing into the early hours of Thursday morning. But yeah, as we go into Thursday, that rain band's going to clear off to the east in the early hours, and we're really just going to be left with some isolated shower activity about the southern and mountain districts by sunrise on Thursday. It doesn't look like there's going to be a whole lot in it, maybe a millimetre or two about the exposed southwest coast and also the West Gippsland coast as well. But otherwise, falls are generally going to be less than a millimetre. And yeah, just a slight chance for showers as we move further inland, and should be dry about the northern plains as well. And that's a fairly similar story for Friday as well, with that risk of isolated showers about the southern and mountain districts. It does look like with a little bit of extra moisture, it'll push a bit further inland, so getting up into the southern Mallee and the northern country in the afternoon on Friday. But again, the falls are going to be very light with any showers that get that far north. And then we're going to see that sort of ridge, which is pushing in behind this front, start to drop a little bit to the south and continue to strengthen over the state during Saturday and Sunday. So we'll see the showers pretty much completely clear. It will start to warm up a little bit, particularly as we move into the early part of next week. But at this stage, it does look like that high-pressure system is going to be quite slow moving. So the centre of the high isn't expected to get into the Tasman Sea probably until the early part of next week, maybe late Monday or during Tuesday. So we'll see temperatures gradually start to rise. It will be a bit moderated in the south with continued afternoon sea breeze activity. But by Monday next week, we should see through the north temperatures getting back up into the low 30s and in the mid-20s through the south. And it looks like they'll continue into Tuesday with the temperatures sort of gradually warming as we go into the middle part of the week. And at this stage, looking into the absolute crystal ball, it doesn't look like there's going to be any change on the way until maybe the latter half of next week. So after the rain tomorrow, it does look like we're in for some warmer and drier weather as we move into the weekend and the early part of next week, Warwick.
So this is the last big chance at rain, at least for a little over a week?
Yeah, it does look that way, absolutely.
And as far as warnings and so forth coming with that system tomorrow, you mentioned the wind and so forth. Is that something for us to keep an eye on?
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll have that severe weather warning out between 4 or 5 o'clock this afternoon. And then we also have a fair few marine warnings as well, with the northerly winds strengthening and then the quite gusty westerly change behind it. So, quite a few warnings around wind for Wednesday. At this stage, probably not envisaging any other warnings with sort of any slight risk of thunderstorm activity just confined to western parts of the state in the sort of morning period. So it does look like most of this sort of heavier rainfall is going to fall as rain and not so much associated with thunderstorms.
Now, before we let you go, Tom, is there anything at all over the next week we need to know?
I think it's really the rain and the wind tomorrow. Once we get through that, it does look fairly settled, albeit a bit warmer and drier as we move into next week.
Now, Tom, as we found out yesterday, you are by far the most important person in our show, the Weather Cross, so I hope you're feeling valued today.
Fantastic. That's great to hear.
Tom Delamotte at the Weather Bureau taking us through the Weather Cross, and we didn't do good enough yesterday, so hopefully that makes up for it with a fair bit of news about weather coming and rainfall coming, 5 to 15 mils sort of at the bottom end for most of you. So hopefully if you've got a gauge and you have something to report tomorrow, we'd love you to send us a text to tell us what sort of weather you're having as the rain comes across the state, especially tomorrow and probably final figures on Thursday, really. 0467 842 722 is our text line here on the Country Hour. You can use it to get in contact with us, and we'd love to hear from you, especially with some weather reports coming tomorrow. 0467 842 722. You're listening to the Country Hour. It is 17 to 1. Food miles, paddock to plate, buy local, these are all phrases that have become more common in recent times, coinciding with the rise of farmers' markets and small boutique producers. They're just part of the National Fair Food Week, coordinated by the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance, which over the past 12 months has grown from around 150 members to 600. Michael Kavanagh reports the alliance, comprising of primary producers, food outlets and academia, is using events around the country to push the interests of the smaller producers and associated industry in areas such as regulation and marketing.
Todd Richardson wears two hats as a chef operating a cafe with his wife Lisa in Port Macquarie while raising chickens and heritage pork and growing vegetables. In those roles of paddock to plate, he produces product which fits with his catering philosophy of based on what is available seasonally.
It is very hard to continually get food. Obviously, food doesn't grow all year round. It is very seasonal, and on the farms you have things to contend with, like an animal may break a fence and eat half their crop, or you may have a massive rain event, or you may have a drought like what we're nearly in at the moment with no rains, unless you have access to irrigation, it's very hard for farmers, which we're finding out with our own property. It's very hard to keep up with the demands for what you need for a menu.
Diners come in and they expect certain food and they'll say, but that product is available in the supermarket at the moment, but in that case it's been shipped in. Is it difficult for them to accept that there is food only available at certain seasons?
I completely believe that the current way people think and have access to food is completely wrong. It's hard to get people to realise that stuff doesn't just grow all year round.
As people are looking at locally sourced food to eat, how difficult is it to find primary producers that can meet your requirements?
That's really hard. We're one of the busier cafes in town and we go through close to the likes of 9 kilos of rocket a week. So to find somebody that can produce that amount and consistently supply that amount is really hard.
He was one of the guest speakers at the Port Macquarie campus of Charles Sturt University, which staged a food fair looking at production, marketing and how to cater to consumers who are wanting to know where their food comes from and how to get it locally. It was part of a series of events being run nationally by the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance, which executive member Phil Stringer, who's farmed in southeast Queensland, says is to provide support for small producers. For example, beef farmers who run less than 100 head of cattle.
We've organised it for this week just to highlight what fair food issues are existing around the country and how unfair the regulations are relating to small farmers. And
what are some of the issues and problems?
The small farmers having to deal with exactly the same costs and regulations that many of the larger ones are doing, and it's debilitating for their businesses. What they need, what we all need, is regulations that are scale appropriate.
Those participating were not just producers and restaurateurs, but also those working with a raw product and then value adding to it. A common concern expressed was that many were working in isolation, and because they chose it not to do with the more traditional outlets, it was therefore difficult to connect. A point which Alexandra Gray, project officer involved with the economic development in the Port Macquarie Hastings Council, noted.
We're really looking to connect those two groups through a Mid-North Coast fresh brand, which we've established, and essentially get the producers and those with that value-added product to list their products on this website so that the chefs and restaurateurs can have an immediate access to this local produce.
Now, the seminar was very much targeted at the small producers, niche marketing, niche producers. Is that what the council's looking at specifically in this area?
Look, I think in this area we have such a diverse range of producers, and a lot of those producers are bespoke niche businesses. So we're not looking to specifically target them, but they are the businesses that make up a lot of this food bowl supply in this region.
The bulk of those attending aim to market locally and on a small to medium scale. Tim Nethery had come along to listen. He grows and processes such things as feijoa, finger limes and Tahitian limes, selling locally and looking to overseas as well.
Just had to do something a bit different. I just didn't want to be a price taker like a lot of farmers are. I wanted to be a price maker. And so we've been able to do that with a high quality product into markets that aren't standard. So we're not talking about something you buy for a dollar off the shelf. It's specialised, it's got specialised usages, and we can demand a reasonable price ourselves so that we can make it profitable, and then the retailer and the consumer know that they're getting a quality product that's different from anything else available.
That is Tim Nethery, who produces feijoa, finger limes and Tahitian limes, ending that report from Michael Kavanagh. And just on along the lines of that story, we're going to do a feature broadcast on small farm enterprises and what they want and what they're lobbying for on our program on The Country Hour next week. If you'd like to add a topic to the list or a question you want us to ask, we'd love to hear from you. You can always send us a text, 0467 842 722, or send us a message on our Facebook page, Victorian Country Hour on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you as we look at small farming enterprises next week on The Country Hour. And we'll continue along that theme now on the program by talking about some interesting things happening in dairy. And no other industry has really been on the roller coaster in the last couple of years like dairy farmers that had borne the brunt of a volatile global dairy market. Now some who aren't prepared to sit back and wait for processors to extract more value for their milk are going it alone and coming up with ways to get better returns on the farm. Larissa Smith has more.
You've probably heard of health advocates promoting diets high in omega-3s like fish oil and nuts. But what about milk? Years ago, Northern Tasmanian dairy farmer Jeff Cox started tinkering with different types of feed to see if his cows could naturally absorb omega-3s in their fresh pasture. With work previously developed by the CSIRO, he knew he was onto something.
Yeah, it was probably about 10 years ago when there were quite a few companies that were trying to artificially enhance their milk with omega-3s. They weren't having a great success. The flavour was never good, and the shelf life of the milk was compromised. So I became quite interested in looking for a way to naturally incorporate omega-3s into milk, and there's quite a bit of science behind it. And during that process, I became aware of the CSIRO science that they've done on a similar technology many years ago. I thought I'd try this process as well, and we improved that a bit, and it works fairly well.
So just explain the biology of how that works, how the omegas shift from the pasture into the cow itself.
Yeah, it's actually a feed we give the cows. It's a feed supplement in addition to their standard feed. We have a process that enables the omega-3 oils to be protected. That enables them to pass through the cow's rumen or their first stomach without being harmed. Then they absorb naturally or digested naturally by the cow in the later stages of her digestion. Then they just pass into the cow's milk. As part of that process, we're protecting protein as well, which is quite a common type of feed for cows, and it's a high-value feed in itself, and it's quite nutritious for the cow and healthy for the cow as well. We like to think that milk's a great product in its natural self, and we're just adding a bit of value to it or producing a niche-type product.
Manufacturer West Haven Dairy took an interest in Jeff Cox's work and released a yogurt using his milk enriched with omega-3s nearly 12 months ago. General Manager Jonty Barnett says it's given the company a point of difference for the increasingly health-conscious consumer.
We've had some really good success in regards to a lot of genuine interest in the product and how it's been accepted by the market. A lot more for the kids market to do with early child development and to do with brain development and eye development. So there's been some really good feedback in that regard.
Dairy farmer Jeff Cox reckons there's more value to be extracted from cow's milk in manufacturing. He's now working with Monash University to replace vegetable oils in infant formula.
There's more and more research coming out that's showing that dairy fats are far superior to vegetable oils in that they are digested much better by humans. Yeah, I think consumers are gradually picking that up as well. And we see a move now towards butter, away from margarines and even soft butters that have oils added to it. Consumers seem to be moving now towards pure butter. And that's because of the awareness that butter's actually quite a good product compared to vegetable oils.
That's Tasmanian dairy farmer Jeff Cox sending that report from Larissa Smith. You're listening to The Country. Our markets are on the way. A few more of your texts coming in, a lot about the weather. Someone says, well done, thank you. I'm assuming that's with the weather report. Another one goes, yeah, Warwick, that weather report's too long now. I'm confused. And Woodsy sums it up probably better than anybody. He goes, the weather drives everything we do. That's why we like to hear what's expected in the week to come. Woodsy, you're right, and we'll try and do the best we can. Thank you very much for your patience. Let's head to markets now. Let's start today with the cattle markets, as we always do. Let's go to Leanne Dax first. Good afternoon, Leanne.
Just over 1,500 cattle were offered in an excellent quality yarning, with most cattle suiting the trade or export market. store types are in shorter supply. Buyers did step up to the plate, with both domestic and export cattle benefiting from strong competition. Veal jumped 20 cents. Veal back to the paddock surged 28. Feeder steers are up by 9. Trade steers sold 11 cents steerer, while the heifer portion lifted 21 cents. Grown steers and bullocks are up by 15 cents. Veal 262 to 315. Trade steers 278 to 295. Feeder steers 263 to 285. Feeder heifers 255 to 279. They jumped 20. Trade heifers 252 to 285. And grown steers and bullocks 262 to 289. I'm Leanne Drax, MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. Let's head south to Pakenham now, find out what's happening there. Hello, Brendan Fletcher.
G'day. Warwick numbers increased to 240. That's 110 more, with the usual buying group operating in a softer cow market and a solid bull sale. Quality was mixed, with more dairy cows and only a sprinkling of heavy beef cows. Prices were a few cents dearer for some leaner dairy cows and 5 cents easier for the beef cows, with processors loading heavy cows for an estimated 429 to 463 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls improved a few cents. Most light and medium weight cows sold from 163 to 214, heavyweights 187 to 241 after a top of 260 for a high yielding Eurobred cow, and heavy bulls sold from 255 to 265. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. Let's keep the cattle coming. Shepherding cattle now. Good afternoon, Nicole Varley.
Good afternoon. Well, we had 800 exports and 500 trade cattle. Amongst the exports, there were 500 cows. There was a good quality lineup of bullocks with plenty of weight. The majority of the export operators were present and competing strongly across all grades. Grown steers and bullocks were 10 to 19 cents dearer. Dairy cows lifted by 6 to 10 cents. Beef cows firmed to a few cents higher also. Trade buyers were keen for quality, although veal numbers were limited with not many light-weighted calves about. Yearling steers rose by 5 to 13 cents, with the heifer portion also 5 to 8 cents better. Bulk of the vealers made from 284 to 320 cents. Yearling steers to the trade 288 to 312. The yearling heifer portion, B&C muffled, 262 to 312 also. There were greater numbers of grown steers and bullocks this week. The 500 to 600 kilo C4 steers made to 282 cents. 600 kilo plus bullocks, 272 to 285, averaging around 282. Frisian steers reached 240 cents. The heavy beef cows, 204 to 236 cents, averaging around 223 for the D4s. Dairy cows over 520 kilos live weight, 190 to 219. And our bulls, 223 to 260 cents. This is Nicole Varley from National Livestock Reporting Service from Shepparton.
To sheep market reports now, let's head to Ballarat. Good afternoon, Tim Delaney.
Good afternoon. A large rise in land numbers at Ballarat. It's 19,000 a yard, 6,000 more for the regular buying gallery. More interest from local restockers. New season young lamb selling period starts to build momentum, with the majority of the feeding now young lambs. Quality varied from very good down to average, with most lambs in good order. Lamb prices showed a slightly stronger trend, as heavy lambs sold from $3 to $4 dearer. Medium lambs were selling $2 to $4 higher. Light lambs sold $2 to $5 stronger and better due to the restocker activity. Restockers are busy, as they paid between $108 to $142 and $35 to $111 for lighter lots. Lightweight two-score young lambs sold from $96 to $112. Light tradeweight two and three schools, $112 to $118, averaging 615 cents. Medium tradeweight three-score lambs sold from $125 to $148. Heavier tradeweight drafts at three and four scores, $144 to $159, averaging 610 cents. Heavy lambs, three and four score, were from $156 to $166. Extra heavy four score lambs, $168 to the market, total $193, as they average close to 600 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Best of the small runs of heavy tray weight old lambs to heavy sold between $128 to $157. Heavy hoggets reach $146. This has been Tim Delaney reporting for MLA Ballarat, with still 6,000 sheep yet to be sold.
Oh, more work to do. Thanks for that, Tim. And that's about it for you on the Country Hour today. We're talking gas yesterday, water today. I do love this text from John in South, who tries to combine it all. He says, if indeed the South Australian government has kept water in store for the people, they should be consulted by the federal government on how to manage natural gas supply so the Australian people have a cheap, guaranteed supply of their own natural gas and surplus only is sold offshore. That's from John in South. Thanks for your text to 0467 842 722. Nicole Javasek, what's on your show this afternoon?
Tony Abbott says that climate change could be beneficial for some people, that the warming of the planet could actually be beneficial overall because far more people die in cold snaps than heat waves. He also has compared the economic harm of climate change policy to, quote, primitive people killing goats to appease the volcano gods. We're going to have a chat about that this afternoon. We're also going to keep an eye on the Western Highway, where a fuel tanker has overturned its deep lead. It's strewn diesel fuel about three quarters of a kilometre down the road, and the Western Highway's been blocked in both directions. And
as you can imagine.
What a disaster. We're going to have a chat about the dark arts of passive aggression. I found a note on my card this morning telling me not to park there anymore, signed by nobody, but very curt and to the point. So we're going to ask if you've ever been the receiver, or maybe you are the perpetrator of the dark arts of passive aggression.
Office fridges for lunches are a good location for passive aggression, aren't they? They're
do brilliant. Not eat my lunch.
Yes, and to the person who ate my lunch. Brilliant. Oh, well, listen out for that. That's this afternoon on Statewide Drive. And this has been the Country Hour for today. Remember to like our Facebook page if you get a chance, Victorian Country Hour on Facebook.